Test, test, test. All right, well, today on Deep Thoughts, we're going to go in a direction I think is pretty accessible for people, but then hopefully we can juice it up quite a bit. And that subject is going to be about waking people up and dealing with indoctrination. Because man has a lot of assumptions and ego involved with what we believe. And unfortunately, most of us are wrong. We're wrong about everything, right? I think that the only thing we can do is attempt to be less wrong. Honestly, think that's the goal. Let's be less wrong. How do you do that? How do you become less wrong? Well, some people might think, well, you study more. You study more and then you become more smart and less wrong. All right. Now, riddle me this. Why is it that most academics run off and have all the time in the world to learn by way of memorizing and repeating what's been written down by previous generations? Why do they always end up saying that all they really discovered was that they didn't know anything? And that the way that they actually remained more in the correct zone than the incorrect zone was by self-declaring that they know nothing. I think that's really interesting, because that's the trend going back as far as philosophers have gone, historians have gone, but mostly philosophers who take the information into the human condition, right? Historians really just memorize words to puff up their chests, right? Look what I know. An historian can argue with another historian about what happened and what didn't happen. But a philosopher has to bring their discoveries to the table and say, I bet if you follow this set of thoughts, this principle, or set of principles, that you will yield this outcome in your character. Or you'll be able to decipher the behaviors of humanity. One of the guys I was turned on very quickly to in my 20s, actually late teens, was a guy named Kenneth Burke. And Kenneth Burke has an amazing life story and is known for something called scapegoating theory. First thing about Kenneth that's cool is that he told his dad, you know what, Pops? Screw these colleges. Why don't you give me the money? I'll pay for rent and I'll go buy the books and I'll teach myself how to be smart. I thought that was super cool. Now, I had that particular scenario forced on me where I was told my whole high school academic, you know, it was only 3 years when I went to school, it was 10 through 12, that if I got good grades, then my college would be paid for. Well, I got pretty damn good grades, except the last semester of my senior year when I had my heart broken. It was kind of funny. I got pretty damn good grades. I'm no straight-A student, but I definitely got good enough grades to be kind of assisted here and there. And it just didn't happen. My parents were just not in a position to help out at the time. What was really weird was that my grandparents had put through several of my aunts and uncles through college. The ones that married into the family put them completely through college, and then they would, like, at least one of them booked at the end. He just got his degree paid for by my grandparents, and then he booked. So my grandparents always had cash, but they never reached over and said, you should go to school, because I already did what I wanted to do, right? So today is going to be about, why do we believe things? What makes us believe something over another? Now, if you've managed to get to the point in your life where you pay your own bills, you're looking at me like, that's a pretty easy question to answer. But then you'll find people in your neighborhood who still believe in fairy tales, right? If you're the person that tells them they're believing in fairy tales, well, you're the enemy now, right? You're the jerk for mentioning it. Now, what I find interesting is that this is all going to be cultural and geographical, right? So I can only speak from probably a majority of the regions in North America known as America, right? I have to tiptoe around this because I have friends that do watch the show and unfortunately do attempt to get offended as fucking easily as possible. So I have to be a little careful here. I'm just going to keep this deep thought real. We are raised in America with a bunch of goofy shit. Let's just keep it really real. A bunch of goofy shit. Santa Claus, which teaches your fucking kid to be an absolute materialistic child. Right? Happiness is objects. And happiness within your parenthood relationship between child and parent is your parent capitulating and buying you a bunch of shit you don't need. And of course, it turns into commercials on television and movies and made for TV shows in the afternoon where children are taught how to extort this behavior out of their parents by means of guilt tripping them. And I want to say, I do have a kid, and she never did this to me, so I'm not talking out of any bitterness from my own personal experiences. I'm merely observing the universe. I've definitely seen this. But we're raised with a tooth fairy, meaning when you lose a tooth, you put it under your pillow, and there's money there the next day. The Easter Bunny. Somehow, some religious story was co-opted by a bunny. And a chocolate bunny at that. And there's a couple stories of how that happened, but whatever. We have leprechauns who live at the end of rainbows with the golden pot, if you can just find it. And I can remember believing in this bullshit. I can remember believing this stuff as a child. Now, you're probably saying, half of you are going, what are you talking about, dude? Those are great memories. Waking up in the morning for Christmas with a bunch of presents, thinking that this big fat dude climbed down a chimney. Of course, I always lived in an apartment complex, so it was always fucking teleported in the room. Or the houses that I lived in didn't have chimneys. But somehow, the dude got in there, dropped a bunch of shit off. It was cool. And I remember being very excited about that. Did have a weird nightmare about the Easter Bunny. That was really bizarre. But here's the problem. As much as we're trying to always protect and coddle children, we are teaching their minds to lie to themselves. To, one, never deal with reality as it is, right? It's if you think about an average school day in America from a kid that's maybe in fifth grade for the whole year, right? They're going to have these celebrations all throughout the year, which is cool. Some of them are cool. 4th of July is kind of neat in America, if you understand what the hell it's about. Thanksgiving, sort of weird. It took the land from other people, and we're going to celebrate it, all right? Then you have this Christmas thing, winter solstice. Then we have Valentine's Day. And then we have Easter. And then you lose your teeth somewhere along the way and the tooth fairy shows up and rainbows show up and somehow that's interesting. So mysticism is overlaid on top of reality from a very early age in America. And so when a kid is taught some other bunch of bullshit from their country, from their church, from their family, it's no wonder they have the ability to digest it for the rest of life. So there's certain ones that we keep for the rest of our lives, and we throw most of it out the door. That's what the interesting thing is. So we've actually been taught that we're lied to from birth. But we kind of, ha ha ha, we laugh it off, right? And it seems harmless until those other paradigms that you keep in adulthood start to cause you to get into massive tribalism. Us good, them bad. And I think it's interesting that we believe, I had the conversation with a friend of mine, and we were debating the existence of Christ. And she's a person, a very sweet person, who just simply said, "I know he existed." And I said, "Well, how do you know he existed? Shit, I wasn't there. I just know in my heart. I just know." I'm like, "Oh, okay. So you just kind of know. It's this faith thing, right?" Everyone who's listening has had the faith conversation with someone. I can have faith in you as a person. I can say, "I have faith in you that you'll do the right thing to the best of your ability. And if you make a mistake, well, that's because you're human. But I have faith in you." That's where I use faith in my life, right? I do trust the universe. I trust the process of birth, death, and resurrection within the universe's cycles, right? So I trust that process. I don't need a religious paradigm to insert itself on top of that and give proper nouns to the process. It just is the process in my mind, in my opinion, right? All right. But people believe that you can teach a child a lie from birth and do no damage to their brain. I believe the reason why my friend can so effortlessly believe in a person that she has absolutely no proof that existed at all is that she was raised with all the other things that had no proof that they existed at all. But she shed them off, almost like training wheels, right? Training wheels are interesting on a bicycle because training wheels are wheels on a thing with wheels, right? So you have the situation where you had a couple new tires, you don't have to balance anymore, and you just ride, and then eventually the animation pulls them off, just like booster rockets on the space shuttle, and then poof, there you are, and you're balancing, right? I think when it comes to religious indoctrination, we have training wheels, which are Christmas, Tooth Fairy, Easter Bunny, what else? Whatever else indoctrination. Christopher Columbus is a good guy, whatever. And you ride on those for a while, rainbows and leprechaun power, and eventually they peel off. And what you have in the center is the adult one. Because nobody tries to make Christmas an adult thing, right? There are some that, you know, worship Christ at the time, and they keep it very serious. But in terms of Santa Claus coming in from the North Pole, delivering, you know, presents, we don't try to romanticize that as adults. But similar stories of similar qualities get romanticized up into adulthood with absolutely the same level of proof that you would have for any one of these fairy tales, with fairy tales inside the story about people doing miraculous miracles, right? In one way, they think he's coming back, right? And just take Christianity for a second. And my position before I go into this, and if you skip listening to this part, you're going to be pissed off at the next part, is that I believe that society needs order. It needs a process. I think that currently in 2015, I'm going up a couple years there, in 2015, schools are so dreadful in the United States of America that common sense is no longer this inalienable thing that happens to you. It has to be retaught. And I think that right now, perhaps, in a lot of neighborhoods around the country, Christian upbringing in the New Testament, if you follow maybe even the Old Testament commands and then follow the teachings of Christ, you're going to get a lot of common sense on how to behave in the world and how to treat people nicely and forgive and forget and be humble, right? And I think we poo-poo that because we think, "I don't need that. I already have this common sense." Well, I think a lot of us got that common sense from someone else in our family who had a religious background who brought it to us. Because my school that I went to 7 different schools before I graduated, I don't remember ever having a school sit me down and say, "This is right and this is wrong." A teacher did, a vice principal did after he beat my ass, but those are little one-offs, right? So the rest came from my family, and my family was all raised in churches, even though a couple of them peeled off and never went back, right? So I believe that Christianity has an amazing benefit to mankind in the United States of America if you don't get carried away with it, right? If you have a good sense of self, I think that you're going to know which parts to keep and which parts to let go by, right? I don't think I've ever been judged more harshly in my life than someone who routinely told me they don't judge people. And they were a devout Christian, right? I don't judge people. Oh, yeah, you do. You know, so it's very interesting how we live in these weird paradigms. But what I want to mention about this indoctrination thing, and I did an episode on religion probably in the 20s of 100 plus episodes, right? And I took it down because it really frazzled a bunch of people close to me, and I thought, oh crap, if it's doing this to people that are close to me, it's probably not going to be a good episode for other folks. So I'm going to take another crack at it here, but I'm going to leave out a ton of crap I talked about, which is the research of one Dr. Atwell, who I highly respect. But I'm not going to try to tell you anybody didn't exist or does exist, but I'll tell you, if you're raised from birth to believe something is true, and if that something is never deprecated like the fairy tales, like Santa Claus, Tooth Fairy, etc., Easter Bunny, and there's an institution that continues evolving the idea, this fictitious thing, up into adulthood, you will have absolutely no genetic chance to ever escape the belief system of that being. And it doesn't matter if you say you don't believe. You can be 98% sure that dude didn't exist. Like, we'll just take Jesus, for instance, right? It doesn't mean, again, that the message isn't wonderful. It doesn't mean it's not man's finest hour. And it doesn't mean it's not divinely inspired. But it may be a divinely inspired story versus a divinely inspired piece of actual history, right? Doesn't really matter. Again, I'm not really concerned about convincing you of anything in that realm, except that the only example I've got for people listening to this is Christ. We don't teach another character having existed that we take all the way into the adult paradigm of belief that I can demonstrate this with, to my knowledge, right? Now, conspiracies that we all fight constantly, right? Those of you done any research on any freaking conspiracy since 9/11 proved to us that the conspiracies happen at the highest levels and they're all based on lies. If you've done any research, you understand the power of believing in things that didn't happen because somebody told you they did. And they told you in an adult voice. They told you an adult paradigm that, you know, it came on the news, you know. I always thought it was interesting when Santa Claus is, you know, fabled to be delivering presents. They pushed it on the news, you know, back way, I don't even know, probably 40s, 50s when they first did it, when they talked about his journey around the world, you know, to all these kids that don't believe he exists, which is kind of funny. Big bags of coal for them. Okay, so when I saw that as an adult, I thought, well, first, when I saw it as a child, it validated him so much. Hey, look, you're using an adult paradigm of, yes, he exists, right? And as I got older, I was like, that's clever as hell, man. And that's what they do to us with religion. And I think the greatest sin about creating a construct, a fictional construct, between us and what we would call our God, right? A lot of us scientists believe in a global consciousness of the universe. There's nothing in the world I want between me and a global consciousness in the universe. Nothing. Nothing between me and that force. I can love my kid more than I love myself. I can love other people more than I love myself and all that great prioritization in my life. But I don't want anything between me and a God. No man should stand before me pretending that he's got this outsourcing service to get my soul there. You know, it's almost like, I mean, when you think about it, they tell you that God's everywhere, right? I think, you know, depending on how you define that, I think that's 100% true. I think the universe is God, myself. Okay, so you can never be outside of the bosom of God, ever. You can't. You can never be removed from him, because if you did, you would cease to exist, even by scientific definition of him being the universe or in some divine state. But they convince you in man-made paradigms every single fucking time that you have been removed from God. You now have this giant distance between you and you. The Garden of Eden, he stuck you in this garden and he fucking booked out of town, right? Crazy. And we believe that shit. We believe that we have this distant relationship between what we are and what we are, you know, what keeps us going, right? We are a part of the universe. You know, at best, you know, anyone trying to tell you that you're far away from God because you sinned or because your religion just starts you off with original sin would be that God would have to be kind of reaching around his back, right? And kind of keeping you alive with his back hand here, playing the back keyboard while he's really playing the chorus up here to entertain himself, right? That would be the way that that whole line of bullshit would work. And that's all it is, man. And then, of course, you have to have someone with authority that has the key to get back, to get you back. Well, I'm going to fix all this, man. I'm going to fix it. Well, God's the one that changed it according to you. So who are you to fix? What do you have, like the black passport to get me, you know, through customs or something, right? Really funny, right? But people buy this crap and they change their lives and they segregate themselves from people that don't believe this horse shit. All the time feeling superior that they've actually done any research on anything, even just the philosophical research in their mind to really kind of sort through the bullshit. I think it's interesting. So why is this important? I promised you this was going to be about why we believe things and the indoctrination pools that we get into. So the first point I just made, just to loop back, is that there is a distinction between the booster rocket beliefs that we have that peel off and go back down to the ground, right? You believe Santa Claus for a certain amount of time. It's a short distance between A and B. And eventually you grow up and eventually it peels off. And then you have man-made religions, and there's a bunch of them. It's not just the one that you might have inside your heart, that have value, have extreme value to help you parable up your life and figure out how to behave. But at some point, you're supposed to own your own life. At some point, you're supposed to be your own person. I always try to tell people who try to guilt trip me about worshiping God, I say, look, man, I pray every single day. I say thanks as many times as I can remember. I don't feel like I'm ever away from the dude. He sure as hell doesn't live at that house down the street that you put a little thing on the top of it. He's there too, but he's here with me, you know. He can't be away from me, right? And they feel this superiority, right? That superiority is extremely important for what religion is being used for in America. Now, if you're from Europe watching this, you have a feeling. If you're in Europe and we'll just throw this one out to our Glasgow buddies today. You look at America and you go, Jesus Christ, look at those people. They are strung out on Christianity. And because they're strung out on Christianity, they go and fight these wars constantly. In the name of Jesus, they kill everybody. Their churches are full of flyers that demonize good people and make absolute evil fuckers the nicest people. People we got to pray for and save, right? The people that are actually instigating wars are the ones we're supposed to pray for, and the ones that are being ceremoniously genocided, right? are called insurgents. You know, it's just, it's weird. It's fucking weird that a whole nation of 350 million people, we have no contingency of human beings in the United States of America that have risen up like I am right now and saying to the world, knock this shit off, right? At least saying to America, what's wrong with us? What's wrong with us that we would shovel our children into wars like coals into the furnace of some runaway steam train, right? But we have an offspring. Probably one of the most difficult things in life to do, which is why motherhood is a job, right? Despite what the Rockefellers will tell you, is raising a child properly. Not just feeding them, not just putting a shelter over their head, not just getting them to the soccer game, but filling their brain with beautiful information that enlightens them, that makes them as left brain as they are right brain, to have compassion and empathy and sympathy for the rest of the humanity, and to contribute through invention or what have you, something back to society, right? So you go through that whole process, raising a child. And I'm going to tell you right now, Tim Burton nailed what I'm about to say in Mars Attack. Jack Black played this character. He was being raised, I think it was in a some sort of like RV or something. He was being raised in a mobile home in an RV or something like that. And his father had raised him to join the military and get into a war and kill people. That was his thing. That was the whole lot. Now, sometimes this just happens and we have to do this. I'm not demonizing going to war when it really happens, right? But that stuff happens every single day. When the parent bottoms out and says, I don't know what to tell my kid to do, right? And sometimes parents don't have access to their children. Now, that's a completely different circumstance. But when you have the luxury and the privilege of having your kid inside your house every day of the week as they're growing up, to somehow say, your manhood is behind that gun. Your manhood is behind not just defending your country, which is the most noble thing in the world, right? But to find the war. You got to find it. You got to be right on the precipice of getting angry at somebody so badly that you want to kill them. That's your fucking goal in life, is to just find that war. Find the reason to pull that trigger. It's no longer a video game anymore. It's real. Get yourself a kill count. Pat yourself on the back, right? Well, what do you think the foundation of that thought is? The foundation of that thought is superiority, and the foundation of superiority, oftentimes, comes through someone institutionalizing a belief system that you got it right, you get to see God, you get to meet God, and everyone else isn't going to meet God. I had, for 11 months, I had Mormons come to my house, a pair of men, you know, young men. And very, very quickly, we had a good time for 11, which is why it lasted 11 months. I just kept having them come back. And you know, I'd learn about their Bible. And they don't call it the Bible, the Book of Mormon, which was cool. Their own little story, Joseph Smith's little wartime tale. But these kids peeled off, and they really just, they lost their indoctrination a little bit coming to my house. And if you've ever read onepagenews.com or you've listened to a bunch of MKUltra radio episodes, you'll know what we talked about, basically. And I was actually furiously writing articles on One Page News at the time. My co-host, Kyle Toucher. And it was hugely enlightening for both sides of the fence. But one of the things I told them when they first walked in the room is I said, let me get this straight. I had this globe on my coffee table because I was going to donate it because my daughter kind of grown past it, you know. And so I pointed at this globe and I said, look, if we were to take a red pen and mark all the land on this globe that is the Mormon church, where it is and where you've evangelized it and that sort of thing, because, boy, they get out, let me tell you. I said, what kind of scratch would we have on this globe if everyone you just talked to instantaneously believed everything that you believe, to the degree you believe it, if not more. And we started doing some basic math, and we, you know, came up to the fact to be less than a single percent of the surface of the planet that's inhabitable, not the oceans, right? And so I said, okay, so all the other people aren't going to go. They're not going to be able to make it to God because they will have never heard your story, and your story is the one, right? The Mormons have an interesting belief that when you pass, there's this mezzanine before actual ascension, because they have three hemispheres of ascension you go to. One is with God and Jesus, and the next one is with Jesus, and the next one is with nobody. You're just all the sinners, right? Consequently, the drinks are a lot stronger in that third one. But the mezzanine, you will definitely get the message of the Mormon Church and of Jesus. There's just, you can't avoid it, which I think is kind of a neat idea. It's a neat spin on it that I've never heard any other religion actually tell you. And then you can be saved. You can be saved in the mezzanine and achieve, hopefully, some of the highest levels of ascension. But they do have a bunch of secret little rules, and some of those escape me. But just that if you do commit certain versions of sin, you're not ever allowed to go to the highest hemisphere. This literally, it's a sphere in their analogy with God and Jesus, right? So I think that's interesting. So what does that teach a kid? I don't mean to pick on the Mormon Church, because all the Christians I've ever met have this feeling of superiority. Now, some of them are more progressive, and they think, well, I don't think God would ever, you know, keep my child from going to heaven, because they still believe in this thing where there's this room up there with clouds and literally a pearly gate, literally a dude up there with a big book of all of our lives, and we're all going to walk through that gate if we're lucky. But the progressive ones always have these kids. I mean, the kids are going secular like crazy in the world, right? Religion is being erased. And I think that when a religion is erased, and one of the things that Kyle and I talk about on the back channel is, like, why would religion be erased? You know, what is this need to get rid of religion when religion fuels the wars? Religion fuels a lot of obedience, you know? A preacher can tell their followers to do all kinds of weird, crazy stuff, and they'll do it. You know, people sold all their homes 100 times trying to follow their little David Koresh to be saved, because he says the planet's gonna end, and, you know, you find out your leader took hiawatha one night, right? Just talking to his hand for 7 hours. But a lot of these people who are Christians today, who are my age, 40 something, they have children that have no faith whatsoever. None. And, you know, most of us just shrug it off. We're like, all right, well, it's up for you. You know, you're still young. You know, these concepts of the universe and where you go and all that kind of stuff, you don't give a shit. So don't worry about it. Just live your life. Be a good person. And you know what? In most cases, 99.9% of the cases, these kids are just as nice and as thoughtful and as empathetic as anybody. But some of them really fear that their kids aren't going to heaven. So in order to deal with that, this idea that they're not going to be with their kids in the next realm, they start being progressive. But they only get progressive to the degree that their child will be allowed into heaven. And then they close the box back down. It's sort of like, okay, my kid's that tall, this wide. Okay, so I'm going to make a door in my philosophy that's just that big, right? Maybe even make it a little tighter so God doesn't think I'm making it too easy on them, right? And think about that for 1 second. Some poor parent has been conditioned to believe that their offspring, their children, are going to be damned to hell, if they don't come forth and take on this legacy system of belief, right? Look at a bunch of old statues and a bunch of fairy tales about walking on water and changing water into wine and all that kind of stuff, right? They are tormented by this childhood indoctrination that has been formalized into adulthood, because it gives, well, back in the Roman days when it was essentially invented, it gave Rome total control over its people. Instead of pounding taxes out of them, it became a talent that you gave to the church, right? You're 10% at minimum, right? Well, automatically, they self-policed. I studied the Middle Ages in high school, for 6 months. My teacher, I was in a really weird writing class, sort of a, it was really weird. It was labeled as a, like an advanced English class, but I thought I got it because I did bad on my, I forgot what they call it, the little test that they give you all throughout the year. So the achievement test, that's what it was called when I was a kid. And they give you these tests. They pull you off into the gym. And it's this weird test that just shows up in the middle of fucking nowhere, right? And it's got half math and half English in it. And I was a businessman when I was young. I mean, my time meant money. I had stuff I wanted to do. And I needed time to relax and play. And I needed time to get my stuff done. And so I walked into that test and I said, what is this test for? Oh, this is just kind of so the state can find out how well we're teaching our kids. I said, okay. So I said, does it matter on my GPA? No, doesn't matter at all. All right. So as a junior high, I got with my buddy and we sat right next to each other and I said, I'll do the evens, you do the odds. And so we powered through this thing, got done pretty quickly, and we had identical test sheets. And then of course the student counselor, the school counselor came to us later and said, hey, you know what the odds are? The two of you actually got the same thing. And he said, you know, they're astronomically against. And I said, well, you know what? Think how fortunate you are to have experienced the one time when it happened. But when I got to high school, I just said, screw this. And I just pounded through these answers, turned it in, and walked out the door, right? Well, it did matter. They stuck me in some, like an English class, which I loved because it was a really cool English guy. I love writing. So they stuck me in an English class because I failed the shit out of that test. It was hilarious. It's like, it's all bullshit that it didn't matter. They actually impacted my required courses because of this weird test. But I had this class. I had two classes I had to take. One was a creative writing class with all my gangster buddies. It was really cool. There's never been so much cocaine and marijuana in one class throughout my entire life in that class. Everybody came back shit-faced from lunch, just drinking beer and stuff. It was funny. So then I got this other class that was really cool with this really neat teacher. It was sort of like a gifted class, the way they managed it. And it's not because I was gifted, it's because I failed this test. But it was like, here, pick a subject and write about it for the whole semester. And so I picked the Middle Ages. So the reason why I mentioned that was that the amount of stories of how easy it was to, well, one, how non-religious Europe was while the Christianity thing was spreading across the whole countryside. It was essentially one of these things of like, okay, if I say I believe, will you leave me alone? Right? That's what the whole Inquisition was about, is to force this down the throats of all the adults so they could move the paradigm from a childish thing that when people grew up, either they didn't believe it at all because they were there and they were like, that guy never existed. I'm sorry. You can't tell me this guy existed. And especially it has some, you know, path to ascension, which I think I already have, right? So it took, I mean, the start to finish, the Inquisition was nearly, there's some overlap in there, but I mean, you're talking about, I don't know, 500 or 600 years. So as the Inquisition kept being turned on in different countries, right? Britain goes and Spain goes, and then kind of nebulously throughout Europe it goes, and people were being threatened. That's where the mercenary was created formally in the history books. I'm sure mercenaries have existed forever, but the Pope was the first time I ever read about a mercenary where they couldn't get the legal blood on their hands of torturing people to enforce their belief system on adults. And so they hired off these other individuals to come in and force people to believe. And if you didn't, you got tortured. And what's interesting about it is when you study the Inquisition, they actually claim that not very many people died due to the Inquisition, which is sort of how they've rebaked the Native American slaughter in America. Oh, it's just smallpox and they try to teach you that the Native Americans just died of smallpox in America. The largest massacre in Native American / revisionistic American history that I've been able to find personally is the Shoshone tribe being slaughtered by the Mormons. It was about 455 or so Native Americans slaughtered in the middle of the winter because they weren't supposed to. The Shoshone would actually go this gigantic circle in America, always being in the warm zone. So in the wintertime, they go down into the Arizona, New Mexico, Mexican belt. And then in the summertime, they go up north to stay a little colder. And when they got finally sandwiched in by all the Americans, or sorry, Europeans coming in and taking over the land, they got stuck up in this really cold region of America, which is Utah, during the wintertime. And so they were freezing their butts off, just not equipped to be there. And that's when they literally got slaughtered. Like, if you find a wasp's nest that is freezing cold in the wintertime, you can just pound them with a hammer and they won't fly because they can't. They're just absolutely stunned due to the freezing cold. So during the European transformation of belief systems, you have this thing pounded into the adults, which is then finally absorbed after hundreds of years of saying, if you don't believe, you're going to be in trouble. Think about it. In 100 years back in the day, you're talking about everyone had children by the age of 15 to 20. So two generations was just 30 years. And then you're getting in the third generation and the fourth. So every 15 years to 20 years, you're always getting a new generation back in the day, back in the Middle Ages, right? That's a bedwork for utter transformation of the human psyche. And I'm willing to bet that on some microscopic level, that we actually have a genetic program in us to accept religion now as a human species. And you'll get folks in the church to say, look, that's probably true. And you know, they'll get you in a youth group, and when you're moving into your teens and they start that glue, they're in that glue process from your childhood fantasies that have all ended to your adult jump into religion. They have to say a lot of things to you, and there's a lot of guilt tripping, a lot of other weird stuff, but one of the things they'll tell you is, can't you feel it? Can't you feel that that's true? And what it is that you sense a higher consciousness in the universe, right? I think most intelligent right-left scientists can conceptualize of a dimension of existence that is our spirit dimension, meaning just a form of energy that is what you are, that's not bound to this mortal coil. Well, at that point, you would think, well, okay, so if a lot of us gathered up our knowledge, all of our little circuit patterns in the other realm, which is just basically non-detectable energy, then we would have all knowledge, right? At some point, we'd have it all in our heads. So we've talked about on the show, I talked about in the religion episode, which I pulled, that we have this belief system that stimulates religions. And there's always a glorified beginning to any story of religion, no matter if it's a celestial body here, like a Jesus Christ, or some sort of beginning of the universe story, right? And we have this birth, death, and resurrection theme that goes way, way back, right? We're talking about Sumerian back. We're talking probably before Queen Semiramis / Queen Ishtar had her experience with this whole thing. And Bill Cooper and a bunch of other open-minded individuals, and Bill's hardly flawless, but we all sort of, and I came to this conclusion before I heard anyone else say it to me, so I think it's interesting, and if you do your own research, you can come to these conclusions that other scientists have come through. And once that happens, you have this amazing feeling of, wow, this is just a logical path of thought. It doesn't mean it's right. It just means that if I could think of this, other people can. It might have more inherent truth than, say, the indoctrination, which doesn't seem to predict anything, right? But one thing that we figured out was that, what is the most basic day of a genetic being on Earth, and pretty much on any ball that circles a sun, anywhere in the universe? The sun comes up in the morning. The sun comes up in the morning, lights the day, gives us warmth, gives us information that we didn't have when it was dark, right? When it's dark, you can't see anything. If you've listened to the show a lot, you've heard me say this a lot. When it's dark, we got eaten up by the predators. We don't have night vision, or at least we've lost it if we had it. And it was just a scary time to be in the dark. So sun goes up, And then the more the days that you live, you know, you start fearing what's coming because it's about to die. Because in your mind, you don't know what's a furnace plasma ball in space, right? So this thing goes up, goes away, and you know you're going to have about 8 hours of potential hell, depending on where you live on planet Earth, whether you have lots of night predators or not. If nothing else, it's going to get cold most of the time. Especially if you're white people living in the north, right? So this joy in the process of the sun going up, going down, and then coming back up again infused in us the dependency on our genetics, our genetics that thrive on the sun's energy, right? We need the sun's energy to create vitamin D, right? It's birth, death, and resurrection. Over and over and over again. Every human being on this planet, unless you're in jail and you can't see the sun somehow, you have this cycle. Even in the jail cell, they turn the light off at night and you go to sleep and then you get up, you know. Believe me, there's plenty of things that can happen to you in the dark in the jail cell, as I'm told. So it seems painfully obvious that the fairy tales about our savior, the sun, who's a savior, right? He is being born and he is living and he is dying and being reborn without a father and a mother. Interesting, right? He is divine. The sun is divine. Now, there's a bunch of conspiracy theories that the sun is Lucifer and that they all worship Lucifer. Because how could the ruling class of the world worship the sun when they're evil? If they worship the sun, wouldn't the sun be evil too? And that's this sort of guilt by proxy thing that's going on with that whole theory. Again, anyone who starts talking to me about Lucifer, I go into coast-to-coast mode and I gotta go, well, tell me a good story. Make it interesting, because I've heard it 100 times, right? There's Jesus and there's Satan and whatever. So there might be a genetic trigger to the whole belief system of all these past religions. So let's say for a second that you can divorce yourself from that process. You can look at the universe and divorce yourself from that process. Well, you get a couple different belief systems once you move out of man-made indoctrinated religions that are taught to us as children, that are based on perhaps genetic triggers with the universe's design. You get agnostic people and you get atheist people. Now, a lot of people get these two words drastically confused. They'll say, well, I'm an atheist. I say, oh, really? Well, what do you think? What's that mean to you? And they'll say, oh, well, I don't know what's after this world. And I'll say, well, then you're not an atheist. You're an agnostic. You don't know. That's what agnostic means, right? An atheist is a fanatic in the inverse of your religious fanatic, right? They spend time trying to tell you that God doesn't exist, something else they could not possibly know, right? So they've got faith in the inverse algorithm of someone who's in the faith side. And it's just, and typically an atheist has a religious background where they hate the religion that they were raised in. Someone hurt them or aggravated them with religion. And one of the most vocal atheists, and you're going to get this name wrong because I know you're guessing already what I'm about to say, was George Carlin. The amazing, brilliant George Carlin, the comedian, who, God bless him, he left us with more incredible gems than you could possibly imagine, and I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if his final heart attack that killed him, because he had a few, I think he had several actually, may have been heavily orchestrated. There's no evidence to that or anything like that, so I'm not trying to put out anything, but the guy was definitely using his HBO specials to wake us up to the ruling class, wake us up to the fact that there's only one party and you're not in it, right? And we post his memes all over the world, you know, his both his personal writings and his comedy. But he was raised in the Catholic Church by nuns. you know, and fathers, obviously, but he, most of his stories are about mean nuns. And he was so utterly jaded by everything that they taught, a heaven, a God, a Savior Jesus, and all the made-up stuff that the Catholic religion created from nothing, right? I mean, when we couldn't read the Bible because it was written in Latin, and most human beings couldn't write their name down, right? They just could pronounce it because there was no means to write anything down unless you were super rich and went to a college. We thought that they were telling the truth about what they were taught from God, that God did this. And of course, they used Michelangelo to create all these paintings to validate their relationship with God, including a incredible painting that consequently a nun named Sister Wendy, if you haven't seen her amazing series on art history, I would definitely go see it no matter what, because you have a nun that shows you a picture of a key being handed from Christ to the Pope. You can just search on Jesus Pope key painting, and you can find it right inside Google. And they painted this photorealistic painting on this wall inside this little annexy little building to the Vatican. Tiny little room. I think maybe it's like 10 feet by 10 feet from what I gather. And they said that when they opened up that room, they had a mile or 11 mile line constant for days, people going in to see this painting. And there was something very interesting. This nun is telling you this, which is crazy. She's actually sort of, she believes in everything. She wears a habit the whole time. And she said that this painting was to convince the people of the world that this actually took place for one very specific reason, which is lost on most people nowadays. She said that it was forbidden to paint photorealistic paintings back in that day unless you had church permission. How fucked up is that? Why is that? Well, it's because nobody knew how to paint like that except for a couple masters, right? And it's not literally true, right? Other cultures were doing it like crazy. But in their little sect of European white people, it's pretty rare. If you go all the way back, you know, to the beginning of the story of Christ. And so when someone saw a painting that was absolutely photoreal, they believed it was real. They believed they were seeing a photograph, that only God himself would have allowed this painting to portray reality in a certain way. And so when people saw the key being handed over, they thought, well, there it is. There's the proof. I've seen it with my own eyes, as they say, right? So again, I talk about that solidification between childhood beliefs and adult system beliefs, and this painting was a very strategic moment in history when the two were melded together with a visual aid, right? So George, you know, in his bits on stage, you'll have him tell you that God doesn't exist, which is interesting for his intellect, and he has a really funny joke about how he made Joe Pesci his God, because Joe Pesci can get stuff done, right? It's the most hilarious bit. But so that's one of your sides, right? Your atheist side, where you almost get, well, I think you do get a pound-for-pound delusional take on reality, which, again, could be true to the inverse of religion. Then you have agnostic, which I think is a growing sector of the world, where because we're good people, we simply say, I don't know. I don't know what's after this world. Now, I think that you're going to go through stages. If you're younger, or this is a new thought for you, where you're kind of going, well, you know, I am kind of coming out of my church indoctrination, because I am realizing it was taught to me from childbirth, and it's always been adults on me, guilt-tripping me, trying to exile me from my family and from my friends and from society if I don't say that I believe, right? They're going to try to size you up. Well, of course you believe, right? One of those kind of statements, right? Only assholes talk like that, right? Or extremely shallow people. You should never say that about anything, you know? You could say, well, of course you know your name is Jason, right? You just know that for a fact. Okay, those are empirical facts we can kind of lock down on a piece of paper. But I think we'll find that even that's taken for granted, right? Unless you have your birth certificate in your hand. But the agnostic belief system is interesting, but it lacks formality. There's a pretty formal group of people that are atheists. And I think they lack some of the formalities as well that are needed. And you're probably going, what are you talking about, formalities? Well, in religion, you have formality of behavior. You should be a good person. Now, even if the subjective Ten Commandments are written down, maybe you don't want to believe one of those. A lot of people who don't study Christianity, they fail to understand that before Christ was rumored to have existed and died for your sins, that this original sin thing was always the game at the beginning, right? Garden of Eden is an Old Testament thing. Christ wasn't around, and tons of religions across the world believe that beginning story. At least they preach it, right? So you were supposed to slaughter an animal for your sins. A lot of temples around the world were built with concentric walls inside, right? So you have a big wall on the outside and then an inner chamber, an inner chamber, inner chamber. And you had to be a higher and higher level priest to get to the center of that church. And at the very center chamber, most of the time, were altars. And they were sacrificial altars where they would normally kill a lamb. And they would have these grooves that were dug into the ground that went underneath all the walls outside to the main gathering cobblestone street outside where all the normal patrons were allowed to be. And some of these temples had big giant areas inside the first chamber so you could actually go in and sit down and then listen to a sermon or whatever. But they would slaughter the lamb while this blood would go down this trough and out to the street. And when they saw the blood come out from under the walls, and this kind of like aperture about this big, you know, a sort of big trough of blood comes out, everybody would yell hooray that their sins were forgiven. And so one of the coolest things about the story of Christ is that I love is him coming down going, what are you doing? I'm going to take care of this whole thing for you. I'm going to sacrifice myself on that cross and it's all over. You're completely absolved of all of your sins for the rest of time. Just believe that I am the Son of God. My Father is the one and only God. And then if you want part of him inside you, it's the Holy Spirit, the Trinity, that will go inside your soul and give you kind of one relationship with your God. Like again, as we said, even if you're a technical believer in God due to science, you would believe that God has to be everywhere all the time, right? But the formality that we're missing is a lesson system of behavior that is formally taught to anyone who doesn't want to believe in a man-made religion. Pick any of them. Pick any man-made religion from any walk of life on this planet, past, present, or future. Once you come out of that system, and someone could argue that any type of belief system you have is a religion, but I would profess and suggest that agnostic belief system is the belief in the I don't know. It's almost a belief in the I don't know what I believe. Now, there's Gnostic people, too. That essentially kind of, they're self-defeatist, right? It's kind of like, well, screw it. It's just the way it is. We're just going to live in the now. And there's a lot of value to that as well. And that's actually a growing community in Los Angeles. I think that's sort of how a lot of people do the bad things that they do at the upper echelons of entertainment and finance. You know, they don't. You know, you can't truly be, I don't think, any type of leader in the world the way that we currently run this planet and believe in anything that you have any accountability to, right? The CEO of Nestle says that water is not our right. This piece of shit gets up there and says that a strategic resource of life is no longer your inalienable right to have. But they can drain all the water supplies in California and turn it, you know, a free product into basically printing money, right? These companies print money. When a bottle of water costs them 3 cents to make and they're selling it to you for $1 to $3, they're printing money from, they're stealing money from you, right? Of course, they legislate the quality of water to go way, way down, and then they also pump up all the propaganda about how dangerous water is that's safe, and so we buy it anyway, right? And of course, they fluoridate it, and they love the idea that some of us are waking up to fluoride because then we're buying a bunch of products to get the fluoride out of our systems, right? So I believe that we don't have a replacement for religion at this point in terms of how to behave and how to grow up. Now, again, some of you, most of you listening to this show are like, dude, we get it and we teach our children how to get it. Understand you're rarer than you think. You're much rarer than you think. In my eyes, I just see that I think being good is an innate thing with man because we do have self-preservation. We know we don't want things stolen from us. And so we think that if we steal it from someone else, unless you're an abused child, you have an empathetic bone that can feel the loss of another human being, which is why we don't steal something from someone else. But there's a caveat to that one as well, which I've discovered, which is a lot of parents these days are being duped into this notion that they want to keep their kids children forever, right? They're growing up too fast. It's like, okay, maybe kids in the slum dogs of India are growing up too fast. You know, maybe in some war-torn area of the world, and it's probably even half the population of this planet is in an area where children are probably going up a little too fast, right? They're seeing suffering that they should never see. But in the end, you can't slight them because they're probably going to have a much better understanding of the human condition if they can just simply survive childhood in a poverty-stricken area of the world, right? So how do you do it in a first world country? So here we have a lot of coddled children. It's starting to kind of peel away because the baby boomers were, in America at least, the baby boomers were huge, right? Because here we have a phase where we won World War II. Bunch of people started screwing. Track houses came out of nowhere to try to house all these families. And then we had parents that were trying to give their children something they never had, which was a good life. Nothing you can do to slight that objective, because that's a sweet objective of any parent, right? The problem with that is that it creates a society of kids that are now hell-bent on socialism. And I've talked about this in the past. You know, once their parents passed away that took care of them the entire time, they need now someone else to be that parent, some mother goose to be the supplier of health care, the supplier of their food, the supplier of their job, supplier of everything, because their parents have been doing the job their whole life. And when their parents passed away, they ate up the inheritance in 2 seconds on junk, thinking there's going to be some other system of supply from someplace, right? Now, little footnote on that. I have a lot of friends in the Hollywood area that are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And some of them, and they're brilliant. They're utterly brilliant. And they did not get caught up in the negative ramifications of what I'm saying. They grew up to be very, very responsible people and great parents and great grandparents. But what they told me, which is very interesting, is they grew up in the 60s, and at least a couple of my closest friends were raging hippies. And when I talked to them about that era, they made some serious distinctions about what a real hippie was and what sort of this popularized hippie thing is that's going all over Hollywood. Now, if you ever see a hippie portrayed in a movie that's a comedy or something like that, they always portray them as sort of completely irresponsible human beings. And I guess that the reality is that they were. But the ones that started the movement, the ones that actually pioneered all the originality that became the hippie movement, were actually extremely responsible individuals. And what am I talking about? Well, communes were the telltale sign of where humanity is at a genetic level. And it goes something like this. at least two of my friends spent a lot of time in communes, a couple of them, a couple different communes apiece. And they said that they would go into these communes and they'd set it up and everybody was gung-ho. But because they're all baby boomers, right? What would happen is that, and they almost gave me the same percentages, so I'm going to say a percentage because I heard it several times. 97% of everybody in the commune ceased working very quickly. And 3% did all the work. 3% understood what they were doing, what their overall goal was, and 97% of them sat around, did nothing, never got firewood, never cooked any food, never sewed any clothes, never cleaned up after themselves. And so the 3% left and left these 97% to just fail. And look at reality right now. Look at where we are right now in the United States of America. We are at the upper adult level, hell-bent on socialism taking over America. There's a whole force of MKUltra listeners that are trying to say, bullshit, capitalism is corrupt because it's been corrupted, not because the theme of its supply and demand and getting rewarded for working hard is corrupt. That's not corrupt at all. That's the way it works, right? Even within your own household, if you had three kids and two parents, the ones that work hard are the revered people in the family, and the ones that sit on their asses are the ones that everyone goes, well, that's a lazy person right there. They do not deserve two helpings of the food. You know, they don't deserve anyone to fold their clothes for them or anything, right? Well, one thing the reason why I mention this is that what I'm finding out right now is that there's a couple different species of millennial kids that I'm seeing even still. And kids, you know, people my age too. Pretty much the whole gamut of people that are alive today. They have, if they've been coddled, there's two weird things that happen to them. And one is that and this has been written about quite a bit, is that empathy is dying in the world. And empathy and sympathy are heavily misunderstood. And I think most of our listeners understand the difference. But just to clarify real quickly, sympathy is feeling sorry for someone else. I'm sorry you're broke. I'm sorry you don't have, I'm sorry you're homeless. Empathy and empathetic feelings are feeling what the other person feels and saying, my God, you must think I'm a jerk. I'm so sorry. I feel what you feel. Either I've been in your situation before or have a powerful enough grasp on the human condition that I can say, I get what you feel. And that's the thing that's dying off like crazy. That's why people text and drive, right? They'll be in jam traffic, reading their phone, not realizing that if they don't go when the cars go in front of them, they're keeping everyone behind them all stacked up. And so they're utterly oblivious to other people. They have no empathy. And I think that this happens naturally if you overcoddle your children because, and even your parents, some of you kids overcoddle your parents, right? Your parent is failing and you don't want to see them hurt, so you take your salary and you give it to your parents. Now, some of you have real good reasons for doing that because you were given their salary back in the day and put through school or whatever it was, right? I come from a family that does not burden their children. That's just the way we live. If we rot in a hole, then we rot in a hole. It's our own fault. We do not burden our children with this crap, right? Now, I haven't turned 100 yet, so maybe I'll change my opinion as I get older. But I would, at this state of my mind, unless I'm delusionally drugged or something like that, I would never burden my child with my existence, no matter what. No matter if I had 100 kids and one of them became a millionaire, right? I'll let that be their decision, right? But the other one are these kids that can't deal with reality. They can't deal with their finances. If they're overcoddled, they don't have any skills to take care of a household. So it used to be, when I was young, in the 70s especially, the men went off and joined the rat race. The rat race every human being was trying to get out of, working for corporate America, slaving away. You didn't get to see your family. You barely got to see your spouse, your wife, because back in the day it was a male thing. And the moms were home busting their ass, raising all these dynamic kids, right? These chaotic children that if anything went wrong in their upbringing, whether it be a genetic trait or just one of them got slipped away from your ability to convince to be good, which is not your fault, you were saddled with a job just as heavy as the husband going off to work. And of course, we've talked about this on the show, that all the women were convinced that being a mother wasn't a very good job, that you had to join corporate America and be taxed, right? That's why all the houses are take two incomes right now, right? So, but these, I was at a restaurant here locally. We got a place down the street I like to eat at, and they hired a two girls back to back. They fired the first girl, and it was an interesting sociological experiment I was watching with these two girls, and the second one's still there right now, but I can't imagine her lasting another month. One of them came in entitled, and she couldn't get it in her head that her job was to be a waitress, that taking on that job actually required some courtesy, some service, and she would just be crass, and she had a horrible voice, unfortunately. She was not, you know, just kind of sort of her genetics that made it really kind of a sawtooth sound coming out of her mouth. But she would rarely help anyone out. She wasn't a bad person. I talked to her at length, and she wasn't a bad person, but she just didn't get it. And she was constantly in trouble with the law. She just moved here from a different state, and she was just screwed up. And it was, she couldn't understand why society wanted to impose rules on her for her bad behavior, because she was breaking the law a couple times, right? And then she got replaced by a girl who might actually be the most lost human being I've ever seen in my entire life, and that's not an exaggeration. This girl has deer eyes the entire time. She has a room full of maybe three tables, you know, like six people. I can't figure out how to take the order and get it to the person. You ask her for something, she says okay, and then she'll, talk to two people, and she's completely forgotten what you need. And it's big items, not like the rest of my food that I paid for. Could you get that out to me anytime soon? Yeah, sure. And it never shows up. And then you have to deal with the owner saying, okay, she didn't bring that to me, and so I need my money back. Or I need something I can take home, right? By the time you're full anyway, you don't want your crap. So I'm seeing this erosion due to our belief systems being completely out of whack in the secular world, right? In the non-religious world. When I go back to my hometown, which is about, I don't know, maybe 7,500 people, everybody knows everyone, so there's immediate accountability between the souls, and there's this upbringing of behaving, because I would speculate that over 90% of my hometown goes to church, or someone in the family goes to church devoutly and brings home certain minimum standards that you have to follow in order to be a part of the household. And so the service blows up when I go to the Midwest in Kansas, and when I give them a tip, which is hilarious, where I'm tipping kids here that complain about being in their job. It's crazy. The girl that got fired from that job was complaining the last day I saw her that no one was giving her any tips in the tip jar. And I didn't have the heart to tell her, you know, it's like, it's because you suck. Because it's like, you don't treat anybody with any courtesy. Because in her mind, she was. Because what sort of courtesy structure can you build in your mind if you're totally entitled to everything, right? It's weird. But when I give a tip in the Midwest of half the amount that I give here, which I don't actually... I actually load these kids up pretty good in the Midwest. They just flip out. They think, you know, I'm a millionaire or something, because I gave them a $6 tip for basically $10 worth of food or something like that. I just like seeing their eyeballs pop. So I think that here's what I'm getting at with this deep thought. If you're out there listening to me and you're religious, well, then I think you're in a pretty safe circumstance, as long as you don't take it to the point where you're justifying harming other people with your superiority. And a lot of times people say, well, of course I don't do that. I'm a good person. Just think about how you think about the indoctrination of the people in the Middle East, the indoctrination you have for people in North Korea. They've got nothing, right? They've got absolutely nothing, least of all a nuclear weapon, least of all an army that could beat up an average, you know, Boy Scouts team here in America, right? But you have a rule system that's got tremendous value to society, and you have it through faith in a belief system that may or may not be technically true, but maybe that doesn't matter. maybe that doesn't matter as much as we think. But it's a divide. It's a divide that creates tribalism. I certainly feel it. The moment I feel tribalism for Christianity here in America is when someone's trying to judge me. Right? And what's funny is that these people that are judging you are sort of assholes in the first place, because they would even think to do that, right? And I don't know the numbers. I don't know what are the numbers of someone who is judging me or that would judge me. I don't know. I think it would be a lot. Out of 350 million people in America, you take the small slice that believe in Christianity or whatever slice it is, and I think it's going to be quite a few people. They're going to run around being superior to others. Now, before I go off into the secular side of the things, if you're listening to me and you believe in that religion, then I think that one of the things you could do is be more Christ-like, to use your own belief system. You know, this guy would show up in town and hang out with the prostitutes, the lepers. He would also chill out with, I think Matthew was a millionaire. I think Matthew was extremely wealthy because he was a tax collector. And he would hang out at these palatial palaces that these guys would own and party hardy, several day parties. There's just in a couple little passages in the book of Matthew, you know. So essentially they were socially ambidextrous. You know, they were able to be with all people. And I think that if you want to do your religion a gigantic service, any type of tuning of the religion to your own children, your own offspring, and your fellow man to say, look, we got to be a little bit more progressive in the way that we apply our faith. You know, it's sort of one of these things of, well, at a minimum, be a good person, and I'm pretty sure God's going to take care of you. I think that's what a lot of people are kind of, and I don't know if it's a majority. I would hope it's a majority, and 51% is a majority, right? That they would actually sort of recondition their belief systems such that that's possible, you know? If you're an atheist, I would definitely check your theories of what you're actually disgusted at, because every form of belief that we have is sort of an algorithm of belief, right? The algorithm that an atheist that I've talked to, and again, a lot of people have it confused. They're actually agnostic and they're not atheists, but if you join an atheist group, then they actually have you picketing religious events, right? When I lived in the Bay Area, they had a lot of San Francisco area of Northern California. There was a lot of atheist groups that would do marches down streets once a year. And they did it just to spite religious people, which I thought was interesting. And I sort of like the idea of order and chaos in the same place in terms of the two extremes of belief systems that need to meet each other, right? But what they need to do is borrow from both sides and find that middle ground, right? Which I think is, in America at least, the agnostic layer that's sort of the basic mean that we grow to when we kind of mature out of hatred, because I haven't heard an atheist talk about their belief system without being very angry at the other side. Now, you can feel a certain pity and disgust and that sort of thing, and it's very normal. It doesn't mean you can find superiority basically in whatever belief system that you have. It's sort of the nature of a belief system. And I think that the most enlightened people on earth, and I will strive to be this enlightened as I'm speaking my entire life, because I will never achieve the supreme enlightenment that I really want. And this is part of that whole spirit and body thing I said in my other episode, where you can feel what is correct. You can feel what you need to believe, what you're supposed to believe, but you can never really achieve it in purity because you have a vessel that is epigenetically programmed to throw your emotions in one realm or the other, right? But as an agnostic myself, where I do use as much history as possible to sort of sanitize my mind, I need to be... It's really funny. I need to be more forgiving, which in one way could be said, I need to be more Christ-like, which is sort of ironic, right? Where I do not allow the feeling of superiority to ever infect my body. Now, it happens, man. It happens. When you talk to people about how we went to the moon, and someone says, oh, well, I know we went to the moon. You go, well, how do you know we went to the moon? Seriously, how do you know? What's your background? Anything scientific? And they got zero college, zero high school, zero postgraduate work while reading their own stuff in any of the sciences, but they know because they saw a statue somewhere in a, like the Denver airport has got a statue of, I think, Neil Armstrong. Maybe it's Buzz. I don't know. One of the astronauts is immortalized in bronze in there just to keep the old fantasy going. But it's hard for me to say, you know, if I interview you just in the slightest about the Apollo 11 mission, about what they said they did, how they got there, what are the different stages of the rockets, what is the atmosphere made out of, they don't know any of that stuff, but they'll tell me we went because they have faith that we went. And that'll be like an atheist, right? The scientific side of things. The guys who said there is no God, death is final, boom, we went to the moon. Another religion, another thing that's been broadcast to their brains, and they believe it without having the background to do so. And of course, you will get the scientists that aren't thinkers. They are merely the memorizers and repeaters who also believe a religion, right? Which is a lot of how all religions start, right? So somehow we have to find this middle ground in our belief systems, which gravitates back to what I said at the beginning of the show, which is that the most enlightened philosophers before even Christianity existed on books, your Plato's, your Socrates, your Aristotle's, they eventually got to the point in their life where they tried to say, look, there are certain principles by which we must live to keep the human condition intact, to be good to each other, to make sure that the biggest guy in the village with the biggest muscles or the biggest stick doesn't get to rape all the women because he simply has the power to do so. We have to come together as a society and protect each other, right? And hopefully we get the same protection in return, right? But we're in a really interesting evolutionary point in world history right now because the internet is crushing folklore. And I think it's to our benefit, almost 100%. Unfortunately, it's also a power, it's a weapon of propaganda to insert in place of that destruction of folklore other paradigms of thought that are very dangerous. And I'll give you a really basic example. One of the things that I think Alex Jones said, I don't think he wrote it, but I think it was a several hundred-year-old statement. It's probably been paraphrased for thousands of years, which is that somebody thinks that giving up a little bit of freedom to gain liberty is a good deal, right? DUI checkpoints in America are usually supported by most Americans, but they don't realize that that erosion of our rights is going to be the end of our society as we know it. So I was telling my friend about this concept of freedom and liberty, right? Which is a belief system, right? And you'll have someone argue with you, well, we need to catch drunks. We got to have these DUI checkpoints. And it's like, no, you don't. No, you don't. If cops want to catch people that they think are drunk, they should sit outside of bars and grab them as soon as they walk out the door, right? Oh, but we have laws against that. Entrapment, right? But they could easily follow people home. They really thought there was a problem. But what I pressed upon her was, look, freedom is nothing more than an idea in the mind. That's all it is. And if we allow thoughts to be policed, then eventually they will develop a mechanism. They will distill a process by which freedom will be erased from our brains. Think about that for 1 second. Sounds impossible, right? It's happening all the time. We have now in America given up our right to not be surveillanced, right? Something that we got rid of 400 years ago, the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which is eavesdropping. Well, now every single thing that we transmit is eavesdropped on, and we're okay with it because a fake event called 9/11, which actually took place but wasn't what you thought it was, has scared everybody into giving up all those rights. And all the legislation to take away those rights was drafted years before 9/11. On TV, we romanticize the idea that we do not negotiate with terrorists. But in America, we didn't pause to capitulate completely to the terrorists. When we've actually pounded the terrorists out of existence, if even their official story is true, we have utterly destroyed them. But we still hang on to all the tyranny that was installed while the fake wars were put on. Again, they're real wars, but they're not, as Tillman said, legal. You should go look up Tillman, 9/11. That's all you need to look up in Google, and you'll figure out why a gentleman was basically assassinated by his own people. Shot in the face for saying, when he came back, this whole thing is bullshit. So our belief systems are being used against us. They're being indoctrinated. They're being moved around. They're being propagandized. And I think that the reason why I wanted to do this episode was that I want you to think of why you believe what you believe. Where'd you get your beliefs? We said on a couple shows ago, if you took all the belief systems in the United States of America and you turned it into a liquid and you put it inside some container, and you said, what percentage of that container is coming from, you know, film and television? I said it in my first one of my first episodes of Deep Thoughts. It's the majority. And whatever slice is not coming out of film and television is coming out of religion. So what do you believe? What is your religion? What are the parameters of your religion? Right? I think it's interesting that religions that profess understanding and sympathy and all those good things are anything but those principles. Somehow people go to church and they read lines that they almost unanimously don't follow. How's that possible? So some of us are going to have to take responsibility for ourselves, take responsibility for our lives, and we're going to have to fix the problem through example. But we're also going to have to fix the problem through verbalizing this with our friends. And we're going to have to walk a fine line to not smell superior while we're saying it. And I would suggest using that phraseology with anybody you think who might be waiting to be offended, right? Because we have these habitual victims in society now that, again, they wait to be offended so there's a prize, right? I still know people that have, you know, a fraction of a percent of Jewish blood in their bones. I think I have potentially some of mine. But when anyone talks about the Holocaust, I mean, you have to carry and toe the line. Otherwise, if you say anything off kilter about the Holocaust, anything, man, they're on your shit like crazy. And they want to have rewards immediately, right? And we've had a lot of people from the Anti-Semitic League come out and say that it's a tool to make everyone feel guilty, to basically get something for nothing. Again, it happened. Well, you know, you can dispute the numbers all you want. It happened. But what's funny is that, or ironic, I should say, is that that anyone who's a Holocaust denier, if you sit that person down, you go, okay, so you're disputing some of this and some of that. Yeah, okay, I do. All right, someone, not me, but someone who's really denying it to high heaven. You say, okay, well, then how do we teach society to be good to each other and to not, one, let go of all of our freedoms so this can happen again? What's funny is that the people who are really heavy on the Holocaust and making sure everyone hears about it every 10 minutes of their life, right? There's still a lot of them out there who have nothing to do with it. They just want that little bone of superiority over people when they can talk about it. They will have no knowledge of the erosion of freedoms. It's really, really strange. I would rather them take their Holocaust stuff and set it aside, or at least present it to me and go, okay, this happened. I'm with you, man. What do you want to say about it? And I would love for them to come back to me and say, this Patriot Act's got to leave. This Military Commissions Act has to leave. And if they rename it, repurpose it, move it around, all that has to leave too. We have to get back our inalienable rights as forged by Magna Carta back in the ninth century, right? It was solidified in 1100 or something like that. But we borrowed from Magna Carta from Europe, the Constitution of the United States, it's all based on those inalienable rights that we have as humans, which is what a republic is, which I mentioned in a previous episode. So I mention all this because I want to hone your belief systems down to the very nitty-gritty of what you're inalienably given as a living being in the universe. Because right now, we use certain paradigms to give people superiority over us. And like, for instance, education. We think that someone who's smarter than us is better than us. And that's weird. All it means is they know some stuff you don't know. And guess what? You know some stuff that they don't know. But you're too, maybe you're isolated. Maybe you can't talk to me. You know, I've talked to a lot of the fans, and they'll say that, you know, they're really impressed by Kyle and I's information that we bring. And I say, well, that's great. I mean, that's awesome that you dig the knowledge that we bring to you. And, you know, I'll quote things wrong. My last episode in 3, I said KMI chip. We're talking about being chipped. And then I gave the acronym, which is Kiss My Ass. And obviously, ass starts with A, and I said KMI. It's a KMA chip, not a KMI chip. It's just a figure of speech that Nick Rockefeller was trying to talk to Aaron Rousseau about, saying they're going to have microchips that will have no one can have authority over them, basically, right? But I make that mistake in the middle of a video, and what am I going to do? You know, edit out a little bleep or something. No one will know what the hell I'm doing. So I just leave all the stuff in there. So in all of our episodes, we have crap that's just slightly misquoted. I misquoted the speed of Earth going around the sun. You know, I mean, stuff happens, right? So what we really want to get down to is what we believe being sort of a protective bubble around our existence. We have to get to that system of belief and have no exclusionary tactics inside that bubble of belief, right? Christianity is based on exclusivity, right? You don't believe in this. You're a Hindu, you're a Muslim, you're a Jew. You simply can't get to where we're going. And even within Christianity, you have, well, they're not Mormon, they're not Catholic, they're not Episcopalian, da-da-da. So there's all this exclusivity. It's all this divide and conquer that we've talked about so much on the show. So I would say, if there's any one last thing we can get out of this discussion between the two of us, right? Thank you for being quiet while I was talking. Is making sure we preserve humanity, preserve what is good about us, preserve kindness and giving, and reignite this missing perception of empathy. You know, if you're a parent and you got kids, maybe mention empathy to them, because I had to go to screenwriting school to learn empathy, to learn what that really was. Now, I had empathy, but I didn't have it on the tip of my tongue as a word. It's really weird. No one really said the word around me for most of my adult life. And until I had to be a writer, you know, I realized, oh, that's what I'm doing. I'm being empathetic to my characters and what they have to think like they think, so my dialogue doesn't all sound like the same person, right? And so that their destinies bang heads because they're different belief systems, right? But it's almost as if we've lost the art of being human, because we have had our minds entirely co-opted by all this crap that's going on. If we're sentient enough to have a religion of any kind, Christian or man-made religion, atheist religion, or agnostic religion, we're not driving that anywhere but inside. We're really just trying to save number one with all those belief systems. And, you know, kind of you want to save your kid, but you don't really pay attention to your kid until your kid doesn't have your belief system. Then you're trying to respond to it. By that time, they're already who they are. They're not going to change, right? So, you know, the reason why we do these other episodes, these weird episodes, or the reason why I'm doing them, as I've said on the last several shows with Kyle, is that, you know, Kyle and I are really trying to fix the world from the top down. Your standard conspiracy information alternate, that we're not really media, but we, you know, we're an alternate view of the world. We're trying to fix it from the top down. Wake up, people who are trying to take away your money. Wake up, that war is fake, this massacre is fake, blah blah blah. And what I'm trying to do is get at the bottom up. You know, we're missing a bunch of stuff at the foundation of humanity, and I think that I can have all the answers, which I don't have, but if I even had all the answers in this backyard doing these recordings for you guys, what use is that unless you guys take it and add your spice to it? You know, filter out the crap that you don't believe in, try to weigh it out. But, you know, maybe if we had a unifying goal, some controlling idea that basically is we want to make sure that humanity is preserved at its finest hour, I think we'll develop a pretty cool, maybe unbelief system, you know, that protects paradigms from coming in and grabbing our consciousness and dividing us and making us against each other. And I'll put a little footnote about screenwriting in there. There is a, and I've mentioned this before, way, way back, but since we're in a deep thought, I thought I would throw this at you. There's a guy out there that I use as my screenwriting teacher. And I go to his conferences, or goes workshops and stuff. Sort of expensive if you go. It's almost $1,000, I think. But it's like, I believe it's 4 days now, and it's almost 12 hours a day. I've met some incredible people at these events, including some pretty amazing celebrities. But you can get his information through a book that he wrote first. He wrote this book first. I believe he wrote it first, and then he started his class. I could have that backwards, but this book is called Story, and his name is Robert McKee, McKee. One thing I realized when I went and studied his form of writing, and I think what I'm about to say is true, because I think most of it's in the book. Obviously, you get a huge, huge detailed discussion when you go to the class, but in order to write a good story, all of this belief system that I'm discussing with you becomes tools for you to tell a story. So you learn about humanity, you learn about what humor is, what love is, all that stuff. And it really educates you on the sociology and psychology of existing in this world as human beings. He teaches a class on genres as well. He's got two basic classes. He's got a class that teaches you how to write your basic screenplay. And the second set is how to write an action script, how to write a romance, a comedy, that sort of thing. And when he gets to the romance, it was really interesting, is he has to define what's love. Nobody can define love, but he's got some techniques that help you understand when you know you're in it, sort of thing. So anyway, that's a little footnote. His book is actually read by him, and it's on iTunes and all their forms of, you know, audible.com and that kind of stuff. So if you have a book reader, if you're a reader, just get the book and read it. Physical copy is usually the best way to go, because there's a few diagrams in there that are important. And who knows, maybe you've got a story in you that's worth telling. And even if you're a novelist or a telewriter for television or some other form of writer, a playwright, his techniques will most definitely hone your awareness of reality in terms of how we live our lives. It's phenomenal. I really can't tell you any more than that without going into another 3-hour discussion. But that's just something I would like to throw at you guys. So again, in conclusion, let's monitor what we believe. Let's have the courage to go back and reevaluate everything that we think we believe. And I would say before you do it, try to define a little kernel of objective that is sort of like a little filter, that every belief system you have has got to pass this filter. You know, do I act superior if I believe this? Do I have true empathy for man if I believe that? You know, all these different qualities that you think you want as a human being, try to hold that up, define it yourself, and I would almost recommend writing it down on paper and push your belief system through it until you find one that just goes ping, 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 and you throw it away, right? And at that moment that you can throw something away, you become enlightened. You become a better human being. And maybe you throw one away and you realize you shouldn't and you bring it back in. But whatever, you're at least consciously crafting who you are as a human being, as opposed to being just dragged through sport worshiping, religious worshiping, and that sort of thing, right? So if you made it this far, hats off to you, because this is a long one. You can always get our main episodes at mkultraradio.com. Again, there's over 100 episodes, so you got to view it from the website to go way, way back. And if you subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is also MK Ultra Radio, somewhere there in YouTube, you can just go to the site and click on it at the top. But if you have a YouTube account, it's the best way to get notified when these drop. We're not turning these into audio broadcasts. I probably will at some future time. But I think they're a little, I don't know how hard they are to follow. I think maybe a face might add a little bit more hand gestures, right, to make it all make more sense. But again, if you made it this far, thanks for listening. As we always say on MKUltra Radio, learn the rules that rule you, because they're going to rule you whether or not you know them or not, right? Over and out.